Yeah, all I can say about 2020 is it's all sideways. It's been a challenge and it's been keeping us up. We've spent some long hours just trying to keep up with the market shift. And that's really what the supply chain is facing everywhere. But ultimately, the thing that has us the most excited is that, we're a family operation. We're family owned, we're family operated. We've got an awesome team. People can call us. They can call our ranch. They can have a conversation with us. We're not out of reach. We're not a big corporate entity. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that people want to have a closer connection with their food, especially when, we're in the middle of a pandemic and maybe a health crisis, and maybe there's some folks open to that idea that our health is important. And that, knowing where your food comes from can be part of that solution.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. Today on Farm to Table Talk, we're literally going to talk turkey. Jason, my guest, Jason Diestel, you must get awfully tired of hearing puns like that. But you have a ranch that raises turkeys, and then you also are distributing them around the country, and you've got a story to tell that is not only about the turkey and a family raising turkey, but then also dealing with what many people think is a bit of a problem for them, and what you do with manure from turkey manure and all the ways it grows. And it's an interesting story. So Jason Diestel, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you, Roger. Happy to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Jason, when you bump into people and you say, I'm Diestel Family Ranch, and they say, well, wait a minute, what do? How do you answer that question?
Sometimes I just tell them, hey, we're in the food business, or if they're a little bit closer to ag, I may divulge that, we're in the turkey business, or that we're a vertically integrated turkey company. Just depends who you're talking to, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I have something in common with you. I've actually got turkeys too. But they're all wild. We live in Sacramento, and I'm over by the American River, and I've got like 25 or 30 turkeys that are just wander up and down the street, and they come into my yard early in the morning, and they perch, they roost in this big tree that's just half a block away, and I've had the opportunity to see these turkey fly, which I never realized that they did, and sometimes they swell up at certain times of the year and look like a Thanksgiving turkey, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the one thing I've noticed with turkeys is they really got this attitude, They're not a chicken or not a pig, I don't know, like the turkeys when you grow them and you're actually have them on the ranch. It's a silly question, I guess, but is there such a thing as kind of like a turkey attitude?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. The turkeys are, I would say, quite boisterous. And when you go into a house with chickens, the chickens, they want to be as far away from you as possible, typically, and they'll run the other direction. Versus turkeys, they're just about the exact opposite, and they will come right up to you, and they want to know what you're doing in their house, in their space. And they're going to check you out. So seems to be consistent.
I kind of love that attitude, and I take a hike down through Sac State's campus and they decide sometimes to stop the traffic, and they'll get out and they'll they'll just stand there and look at a car, and the cars will back up and they can't get around them. And
oh my gosh.
And the turkey will go up and like peck on the bumper of a car. And these people, obviously they could run them down. I've never seen a turkey that's been roadkill, that they probably exist. And there's even a coyote in the neighborhood. and a coyote stays away from them. It's kind of, I'm sure they don't if they get an opportunity out in the pasture, but around here, the coyotes leave them alone too. They just, they think they got a lot of attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. Coyotes are one of our pesky predators out here. So we try to prevent that from happening.
So Jason, your family has been in the farming business or ranching business, depending on what you prefer to call it, in Sonora, which is right on the foothills of the Sierras, yeah. Kind of up behind kind of Modesto and the Central Valley and up into the hills. What got your family into the turkey business in the first place?
My great uncle Ernest Bottini started raising poultry in the 20s, and my grandpa learned from him as he grew up. And in the 40s, there was a major shortage of turkey, and there was something like 50 independent turkey producers in Tuolumne County alone. And so he thought, well, we've got a bit of space. We can go into the turkey business too. And maybe it'll be a good strategy. And, you know, the family also at the time in the early 1900s was, farming apples, hay, potatoes, onions, that sort of stuff. Whatever kind of agricultural things that we could do to get along. And then my grandpa went into the turkey business in 1949. And he was good at it. And so as other producers quit, he stayed with it. In the mid-50s, my grandpa built a feed mill so he could bring in concentrates and more of the supply chain, more of the raw materials, and have a profitable turkey farm for many more years as a contract grower at that time.
You know, it's interesting that you were saying that turkeys were kind of all over, like they're in your county, that they're, 50 or so, turkey farms. And it kind of reminds me of my growing up in the Midwest, where that way about hogs. It's kind of, there used to be like 1,000 people had hogs just around you, just like every quarter of a mile there are people that had hogs. And then the concentration started taking place and they've like all disappeared. There's like, one large confinement operation for every three counties instead of having, a dozen in a township. And it sounds like it might be some of those same pressures. And the fact that your family survived and continued in the business, I noticed you mentioned one key there was the fact that you actually developed a feed mill so that you could produce your own feed. Now, I think one of the challenges out here in California is that you do need corn and soybeans, and we don't grow that much of them here. So in your operation, do you have to bring corn or soybeans in from the Midwest oftentimes?
Yes, that's precisely correct. There are trains running 24/7 bringing grain out to the West Coast to feed dairies and chickens and turkeys all the time. And so we will, tap into that supply chain and that's how it moves out here is via rail.
It's funny because there's a lot of people here on the West Coast think they don't have much in common with people in the Midwest and think, oh, those people, monocrops and so forth, the criticisms of it and raising corn and soybeans, and they don't realize how important a role it does play with livestock feeding here in California. So instead of growing corn and soybeans, which many areas could, and some do some corn and soybeans, we're able to grow oranges and apples and almonds and grapes and all the other things we grow in California. But you guys hung in there and you've got not only a turkey farm, but you've got a really good brand. You've got a good reputation of Distel turkeys. I've seen places that you go to the restaurants and they don't say it's just a turkey sandwich, but they'll name your turkey. I think that's something anymore that a lot of farmers aspire to. that they'd like to be a brand that a farm to fork kind of restaurant feels it's worth bragging about. How'd you get there? How did you get from, you know, we can raise turkey, we can feed turkey, we can bring grain in and so forth. And then how do you get all the way to, like, today you have a reputation and that is desirable and people want to be sure that they know that it's not just any turkey, but it's your brand of turkey. How did you get there?
Well, you know, getting there is a long process. You know, we've been at it for, you know, 70, 80 years here, and our great uncle before that. And very early on, I think that we decided that we kind of knew what made a good turkey. And that's very different than just, hey, we're going to be turkey farmers and we're going to produce a lot of turkeys and we're going to go sell them and people are going to buy them because it has our name on it. That's not really the way we look at it. We look at it as, hey, people are going to buy this turkey. And they're going to have a great experience with it. And that's what's going to keep them coming back is the experience of the quality of the turkey because of the way that the bird is raised, the consistent, you know, we don't lease cost any of our feed. We feed a premium ration that we feel produces the best quality end product and we leave it that way. And so it's something that consumers can count on. We also do a lot of different things to preserve the quality of the end product. And at the end of the day, customer has a good experience and it happens to be a diesel turkey. And so that's how it's built. And it takes a lot of time. I mean, that's just no easy way. We've never found an easy way or we've never found a shortcut.
Well, it has to start off, I suppose, with genetics, too. I mean, you guys know what you're doing with turkeys, and you've got the facilities, and you know how to feed them and so forth. But at some point in time, you had to choose, I suppose, a certain breed that you were going to feature. What was that decision?
So we have about a half a dozen different breeds of turkeys that we use. And turkey is unique. It's one of the few animals that is consumed in the whole form like chicken is, but chicken is only on a very small weight range. So, you know, you can get away with one chicken, and you can, you know, they're generally fairly small and the weight range may go from 3 pounds to 5 pounds. With turkey, you know, we've got birds that are as small as 6 pounds all the way up to 30 or 40 pounds. So that takes multiple breeds, multiple sizes. But, you know, consumer trends have shifted too. In the 80s, the most popular size was a 20 pound hen. And that worked because you could raise the turkey of the day to maturity, you know, and where that's really where the texture and the finish comes in with the bird. But now the consumers are more interested in maybe a 12 pounder or a 13 pound turkey. And so you cannot take that same turkey and raise it for half the amount of time and have the same experience. And so that requires smaller, slower growing genetics to get a consistent amount of raising time, et cetera. And so that's really where the motivation came from. And so we've had a close relationship with turkey breeders. We've bought some turkey genetics in the past. We've bred turkeys. And we think, you know, we have a program that works very well for meeting the needs of the consumer. But, you know, we're dealing with older lines. And that means that they're just less efficient in terms of, you know, they might eat a little bit more grain to get the same amount of gain. But, you know, that's kind of what you end up doing.
So what came first, the turkey or the egg? Are you starting with an egg on your place or are you bringing in I don't know what they call little turkeys.
Yeah. So poults, we call them poults.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And we start with the poults. So, we've worked with some people that are really good in the breeding, at breeding to preserve the genetics, and we work very closely with them on preservation of these breeds that frankly would just wouldn't be around if we weren't using them. And so it's a good thing for genetic diversity in the turkey world. We get hatching eggs from them. Those hatching eggs go to a hatchery. We work with a great hatchery that is top of their class, and they send the poults out to us once they're hatched.
Are they in California too, or?
No, so the hatchery is not in California.
So we see just trucks of these poults that are coming into California in the foothills of the Sierras, and they get into your facilities. Now you have some that's organic, or is it all organic? I see you have some, at least.
Yeah, we have a pretty good amount. Not quite half, but a pretty good amount of organic. We also have non-GMO, so turkeys that are fed grain that is, it's not organic, but it's also not genetically modified. That's a fractional percent there. And then we also have just our regular, you know, premium diesel turkey that is no antibiotics ever. Yeah. And so so those are the three different levels.
Well, it's not easy to find organic grain. And especially I think in this country too, there's so much of the corn and soybeans are GMO, Roundup Ready and so forth, and different products. And so I would imagine that takes some effort too, just to chase down the feed you need. And yeah, I'm sure it's more expensive.
Yes. And you know, part of that is also, you know, our suppliers are participating in genetic testing of the feedstocks. So before we get them as part of the non-GMO project verification on organic and non-GMO sources, we need clear test results to verify that those batches are, the integrity of them is not compromised.
Well, there's so many things to talk about here, and I want to talk about these facilities that you have. So you end up having, what are they? How would you describe them? Big barns of some sort?
Turkey ranches, yeah. So they are large barns, about the size, the width of a house, and the length of a football field. And that's, you know, birds are started in a brooder house. And so we've got some larger ones, smaller ones. In our area, in the foothills, it's not all flat. We have a lot of rolling hills. Okay. And so, you know, you, depending on the topography, you fit the barn where you can. And so we start the poults off when they're a day of age, and they have supplemental heat. Then they're moved to the grow or range barn when they are 6 weeks old approximately. And then they've got outdoor access during daytime. And basically the outdoor access areas are the same size as the house on either side of the house. So you've got two outdoor pens that we can kind of rotate. So you give access to one side, rest the other side, and vice versa.
So you get some of these barns as long as a football field. Is that all open, or are they broken into several different units in the really long buildings?
So they can be one single open span in the barn, or we can divide them up if necessary. But the barns are typical California style. When they used to be shed roofs in California. So originally turkeys were raised out in the broadacre pens under the oak trees. As things kind of came along and started modernizing, we had shed roofs, and then they started putting little sidewalls on the sheds and curtains and poultry netting. So we basically have a giant 5-foot opening at all times with a curtain on it to control airflow. But the birds have plenty of fresh air blowing through the barn. Sunlight is going directly into the barn as well. So it's a pretty nice raising turkeys in California compared to other parts of the country.
So really with that size, the size of barns you got in the outdoor space, they can go out and put some laps in. I think that I look at my wild turkeys and they've got a certain routes that they go down my street, they go up over, they go down by the river, they come back again, and they just keep pecking around and just keep moving through. I would imagine that turkeys in your facilities, they're just kind of moving around all the time, aren't they? Just kind of moseying here and there. And
they are. And they get out, they pick up, they'll eat rocks and grasshoppers if they're available in the spring. And that's one of the coolest things, is to see a bird outside eating grasshoppers, chasing them around. It's the neatest thing I've ever seen.
Actually, they're getting such good protein too. I've just have a podcast coming up with somebody that grows grasshoppers, and this is in Israel, and the protein is fantastic. You're going to have to fight with those turkeys to say share those grasshoppers with us too.
Yeah, that's an interesting area. You know, I wonder one day if we won't be looking at something like that for a viable source for livestock.
Well, I think we will. I mean, I think the thing is that it's going around the world faster than here, because we seem to be a little queasy about what we eat in the United States. They throw Canada into that too, saying that, you know, just the idea of a bug kind of throws people off. But a lot of places in the world are finding them as a just tremendous source of protein. And but that's another podcast. Now, I want to get to the other end, literally, of this business, because when you get all of these turkeys, there is going to be turkey manure, and you've got a unique approach to that too. So you not only have an excellent turkey, an excellent process in growing these turkeys, but you make something out of that. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so we started composting our organic byproducts from our ranch, from our processing plant with our feathers. And we also take, you know, high hazard fire fuels that, out of the foothills. And it's all really clean. We don't do any, there's no trash in it, no curbside pickup. And so our goal is just to make a really high quality compost with the products that we have, because we're so far removed from larger ag, and we've got a travel barrier. I mean, there's a cost to transporting your finished product. And so in order to bridge that cost, you know, the value of the product needed to be higher. And so we sought out to make a very high quality compost. And I actually went and learned from a group in the Midwest that was making organic compost. They had traveled to Austria to find an Austrian method of soil fertility called the Lübke method. And so they kind of built their composting methodologies from that method and got some phenomenal results. And they did it. They're still doing it to this day. But, you know, they've actually taken conventional corn and soybean farmers with low value crops, comparatively to, like, you know, the Salinas Valley in California, where you've got high value crops, and they were able to make this compost. It could produce a very nice return for the farm. For somebody making compost, putting it on their crops, and we don't have that opportunity. We don't have any arable ground. All of our ground is dry land cattle grazing ground, and then we have our turkeys. And so we sell most of our compost. Making a great quality compost was exciting to us. And the more that we learned about soil fertility, the opportunity for nutrient density in crops, and just the amount of good that it could do in the environment with soil, I mean, it just seemed like a real no-brainer in terms of, hey, this is what we should be doing. Instead of taking raw manure, we can make it much more valuable, much more sustainable, and have a greater, longer lasting impact It just made all the sense in the world to be involved with something like that.
You know, that's a good point, because, I mean, you can go into a facility, and what I used to have to do is with a pitchfork load up a manure spreader, and you can take it out and put it directly on the field. And there's a value in that, and it's certainly replacing some nitrogen. Sure, hit and miss when I think of it in hindsight, of trying to figure out what the nutritional value to the soil was necessarily. But you just knew that's what you do with your livestock manure. You were taking out there. You apparently are getting in some of this brush and grass and so forth that you were saying. You're also taking feathers and grinding them up from your processing plant. And then I suppose when the turkeys are out of a barn, you got what? You have a bobcat goes in there and just kind of loads everything up in a wagon. Is that the process?
So I mean, we'll pull out with a carry-all type of piece of equipment behind a tractor, and we'll pull out the skim the barn or clean it out depending on what the situation is. We take our feathers from our processing plant, you know, off of the turkeys, and then we need carbon, because feathers are high in nitrogen, the manure and the bedding mixture is high in nitrogen, and we need carbon to balance it out. So it's a very small percentage comparatively that you can use of those high nitrogen products. You need a lot of carbon. So more than half the recipe is ground wood and leaves and pine needles and stuff like that from, you know, high hazard fuels from the Sierra Nevadas.
We've got a lot of that.
Yeah, we do. There's an endless supply. So it's a good thing.
You mix them all together, and is it in a trench of some sort, or
it's in a windrow? So imagine a 14 foot wide, 7 foot tall pile that stretches out about 300 or 400 feet. Mm-hmm. That's the windrow. So that's about 500 cubic yards of compost or of feedstocks that we're going to make into compost. We take a compost turner with a counter rotating drum, mm-hmm. and it'll go through that row in about 20 to 30 minutes. And during that time, it adds thousands of gallons of water to the feedstocks, because the feedstocks all come in very dry. Nothing will compost unless you get water to it. And so we will add that water and we'll start the composting process. In the beginning of the process, the cells of those products are just soaking up with water, and they start reacting, and it's more of a chemical reaction at first. And then as the composting process goes on, you know, 2-3 weeks in, it becomes more of a microbial process. And of course it finishes with a very much a microbial process as well. We're looking for a very specific heat curve that allows us to have microbial succession to build structure in the finished product.
So if you went out there in that pile, you stuck your arm down in it, and it would be hot?
About 160 degrees. So you wouldn't want to leave it there for too long.
Isn't that something? And then that's something, how that natural process, how it cooks just naturally, even in cold days, you know, that the compost is just like cooking, cooking, cooking.
It is. Yeah. It is amazing. And you know, they say, you know, with compost, you're doing in 10 weeks what nature does in 100 years. That's the amount of time that you're compressing just by properly managing it. And when we turn, you're adding air, you're adding water, and then you're also dropping the temperature. And in the first 3 weeks, you're turning that windrow almost every day.
I'm learning something again. I've been talking about all sorts of manures for years, but you're describing it in a way I hadn't really quite pictured. Now, is there an odor to it?
So there's an odor in the first week or so. In the perfect world, if you've got the perfect recipe, you could get that odor could be taken away on its own after about a week. We do use a microbial inoculant that helps to accelerate the conversion of ammonia to the stable nitrate form of nitrogen.
Wow. Now, what does it look like?
So it starts off kind of brown and with all the feathers, of course. And so you've got this really chunky, unhomogeneous mix of feedstocks. As the turner goes through, after about 3 weeks, it starts actually looking like compost. The feather quills are nearly all the way broken down by just the heat and the moisture, the microbes, all that stuff just breaks down. And by around 5 weeks, it starts looking pretty good. And that's only halfway through the process. And so at the end of the process, at 10 weeks, we like to see that product be at ambient temperature, and it just smells like fresh, fresh soil, fresh earth.
Does it get darker as it goes?
Yes, it does. It tends to. If it dries out much, we would like to keep it around 45%, 50% moisture would be optimal. But if it dries out down to 30% moisture, let's say, it'll start looking more brown. But with that a level of moisture in it, it's fairly dark, like coffee grounds.
Wow. So do you bag it, or do you just put it in large wagons and deliver them to the farmers that are looking for the compost?
Yeah, so truck and trailer loads. We've got a lot of home gardeners that we'll deliver to. We have a few distributors that supply the you know, local home gardeners, and then we also have a few farmers that we will deliver direct to in truck and trailer loads, and they'll use it on their farms.
So, is this a substitute then for the nitrogen, potash, and potassium, and all the fertilizers, often synthetic fertilizers that people use? Is it a direct substitute or just a supplement?
Well, I have to be, you know, in full disclosure, you know, I'm not a soil scientist, and I'm not certified in any way to talk about nutrients. But from our experience, it is a very good replacement, and it does work effectively to even in commercial agriculture. This strategy can be used to reduce the amount of NPK that is necessary for the crops.
NPK, nitrogen, potassium, potash.
Yes.
And that's the, which some of it has to come from Africa even. I mean, you know, the sources that we have to get for these fertilizers that we use to feed the world, coming from all over. So this just makes it makes so much sense to be able to make good use of the product. Now, as far as the people that are using the product, does it work for organic rules to be able to use compost?
Yes, our compost and most composts, they can be organically certified or verified without too much hassle. Now, Roger, real quick, on the nutrient conversation, you know, the beauty of a well-produced compost is that the nutrients are actually, they're actually buffered. And so, you know, if you go put Miracle-Gro on your lawn and you get that big flood of lush green, those nutrients are going into the plant, whether the plant wants it or not. And some of those nutrients you may not be getting 100% of the nutrients to your crop. Some of them could be leaching. Some of them could be volatilizing. With compost, what we've seen is that because the nutrients they're essentially coated, they will stay in the root zone of the soil, and there will be available nutrients when the plant needs them, and they will be banked. And so excesses and deficiencies can be brought into line by using this strategy, which is, you know, it's different than just saying, well, I have this much nitrogen. I have 50 pounds of nitrogen that I'm applying, and we're looking at 50 pounds of chemical nitrogen and 50 pounds of nitrogen in our compost and saying that they're the same, when in reality they're not.
You know, Jason, it just is a kind of, it's a miracle, you know, when you talk about this approach. But I've heard that there's not enough compost to go around. I mean, as people are finding out about it, and certainly organic production seems to keep increasing. But trying to source compost, I understand, is there's it's viewed as having a shortage. Is that right?
Well, I guess, you know, I would say that you're probably right. And I would say that the compost industry has a quality problem. And if you look at, if you say, well, compost is good and yeah, there's a place for it. You know, I think most people agree with that. But when we're talking, when I'm talking about compost and I'm making these claims, there's probably a few people that are going to raise their eyebrows because they think of compost as, you know, the stuff that they, you know, that's $10 a yard or something like that from, you know, their local waste management company that does curbside pickup and makes compost with it. And so there's a big, big difference in the quality of the compost and its effectiveness on the soil. And so we may have a shortage, but it's a shortage of quality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also been a reduction, you know, of composters. There isn't a great track for agricultural composters that want to get started on any scale. The regulations are not making it easier to compost in the last few years. So there's, but you know, I hear more and more farmers that are finding ways to get into it. So that could be a very good thing.
Well, one potential bottleneck too is just the livestock's role. I mean, there's lots of ways you can produce compost, but ultimately, if you're starting with livestock manure and livestock production has been under a lot of pressures. And so even being able to have a viable enterprise that's producing enough livestock to produce enough to contribute to the compost to be able to do this kind of production and the fertilization programs, it's all interconnected.
It is. Yeah, it totally is. And you know, livestock manures are great feedstock to add to compost. There's a lot of value there. You can get that value with a very small percentage of livestock manures. And if there was a way to connect people that have livestock manures with people that have a lot of woody biomass and things that is probably going to a landfill somewhere, then you could really dramatically increase your compost production.
An interesting journey, isn't it? I mean, when you think about the fact that sometimes the corn and soybean farmers back in the Midwest, that corn and soybeans gets on a train and comes out here a couple thousand miles and goes through a turkey and combined with some of this product out of the Sierra Nevada mountains and put together, made into compost and used on vegetable fields in California and then consumed at the local Kroger store in Peoria.
Yeah. It's a infinitely complex and integral situation we have here.
Well, I just want to ask you, I want to flip back to the product again, because you're producing these turkeys and you have a processing plant. So you are processing your own turkeys, right? And you have USDA inspectors or state inspectors in the facility?
Yeah, USDA inspectors that are on site. They inspect every turkey that we process.
And then it's made into these various products with the Distel brand on it. So you can buy sliced turkeys, whole turkeys, you know, you got a food service program and so forth. I got to ask you, in the overall business, because I'm sure some of the turkey was consumed in schools and restaurants that have been closed inside for quite a while through the pandemic, has that had a big impact on on your sales because of those changes with schools and restaurants and the pandemic?
Yeah, all I can say about 2020 is it's all sideways.
I know.
So, we've got product categories that were historically we couldn't keep up with. Now they're idle, and we've got product categories that were doing fine. You know, maybe some retail stuff that was kind of slow, and that's really picked up. And so keeping up with those shifts, as I'm sure you've heard, is just it's been a challenge, and it's been keeping us up. And we've spent some long hours just trying to keep up with the market shifts, you know, because you put a 2 ounce package on a line, and you can run the same packages a minute as if it was a 2 pound package. And so you do the math, you've got a lot of run, you have to run a lot more 2 ounce packages to keep up with the pounds of the 2 pound. And that's really what the supply chain is facing everywhere.
One of the things I would think might be an advantage to turkeys versus some other products is that they're more accepted. Some of the processing, extended shelf life and freezing, and there's a lot of products that don't have to be consumed in 5 or 6 days. And I would think that would give you some more flexibility as an industry.
Yeah, that is very true and a great point. Not something I think about on a daily basis, but you're right. Compared to something like chicken, where chicken is primarily a fresh business, turkey is not that way. And so it does give us the opportunity to put things in the freezer if needed.
You know, again, I think it's just a really, really good story that you and your family have. And if you look down the road, I mean, what makes you beyond 2020, and hopefully we get way into 2021, the things we hope are getting back to normal. But what makes you more optimistic? What do you feel good about? When you look at the future of the business that you're in and the Diestel family and your connection to the turkey business, compost, and the other things you're doing, what gives you the most optimism about the future?
You know, I think that the awareness of where your food comes from continues to grow. Things like organic, as a national category, it continues to grow. And I think that's going to get to another 10 or 15% of organic growth in the nation. And that could really start tipping some of the supply chain dynamics for that category. But ultimately, the thing that has us the most excited is that, you know, we're a family operation, we're family owned, we're family operated. We've got an awesome team, and people can call us, they can call our ranch, they can have a conversation with us. You know, we're not out of reach. We're not a big corporate entity. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that people want to have a closer connection with their food, especially when, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic and maybe a health crisis, and maybe there's some folks open to that idea that our health is important, and that, you know, knowing where your food comes from can be part of that solution.
Well, you know, and it sometimes is a little more expensive too. I mean, I'm not quite sure what your pricing points are, but I think that when people are looking for the story, they recognize that it may not always be the least expensive, but they're also understanding that they're getting the whole story of how it's produced and the standards that you're setting and so forth. And we keep saying that consumers, this is a hard time to bring this up right now because a lot of people are trying to get by on less money, but they do recognize that in some cases our food has been such a value that they have to look beyond the story. And sometimes it's not quite as inexpensive as the commodity.
It's a good question. And the price on the shelf, it's a value, you know, we have a value proposition. You know, you buy a Diestel product, typically you're going to see lower sodium, you're going to see higher protein. We don't put the fillers in the products. It's as just natural, easy to understand. You know, we declare every single ingredient that's in that product. We stay away from things like natural flavorings and catch-all categories to like spices. We don't say spices. If we, you know, we name the spices so everybody knows exactly what's in the product. And we just want to produce a really wholesome, high quality product. We've had several testimonies where people said, hey, you know, I used to buy the cheapest turkey I could find. And as my kids were growing, they needed three sandwiches to be satiated. Because, you know, I tried your guys' product and one sandwich filled them up. And so now instead of getting the Wonder Bread, I'm going for the organic bread and I'm going for the higher quality meat and all that, because I'm seeing a difference in the consumption rate because there's more nutrition in the product. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's kind of the hidden value that we try to bring to the table, and we do that in every way that we can.
Jason, there's some people that are starting to think about go making a turkey sandwich right now.
I know I am.
I am too, and I actually do have some turkey in the refrigerator, so it's always one of our go-to foods. But if people want to know more about your story, I think I even noticed on the website that they can put in their zip code and find out if there's any Diesel turkey sold near them too. Could you tell them where they look online to find more information about you guys?
Yeah, so at Diesel Turkey on social media. You know, we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, our website, dieselturkey.com. We've got a lot of videos and we have a lot of content for recipes. Our online store as well is a great option for these times. You can order from the comfort of your home and have it shipped directly to you. And so that's something we're excited to offer. And, you know, I think turkey, one of the biggest things with turkey is we know that it's great in a sandwich. We understand ground turkey and turkey burgers, but what else are we going to do with it? And because of that, we've got a long list of recipes on our website and innovative ways. My sister Heidi is always making a new recipe and showing folks what they can do with turkey. So we like to keep it interesting.
Well, you are keeping it interesting, and you even think about what you're doing with the feathers, for crying out loud. So it's way beyond the turkey sandwich. And I think that some of the people listening not only enjoy eating turkey and appreciate a good story. The other thing I find inspiring about your story is that they could create that story themselves. I see it across the country right now, across the whole North American continent, as I've talked to people that are looking to developing their own story, just when they might have said, you know what, I don't know if there's a spot for a family farm anymore. But amazing to me are the people that are establishing a brand about something that they're able to grow, and they may not be able to get the distribution. I'm sure they can't do it all at once of what you've been able to accomplish with your family. But they can do it locally. They, you know, start the farmer's market, then they get to something else, and then they're starting to get in a relationship with a farm-to-fork restaurant. So I want to thank you, Jason Diesel, for sharing this story because, again, it's inspiring. I think it's reassuring to consumers, too, of good things that are happening and using all parts of this whole production system, including the compost. And I suppose that's... Is that also information, if somebody wants to know more about the composting, can they get that online too, or do they have to come to you directly?
No, so we do talk about that on our website, and we actually, we'll have blog posts about compost. We'll have blog posts about, all kinds of things people are interested in learning about, and we really try to be a source of information in terms of this is our viewpoint for ag, for food production, and we want to talk and help people understand where their food comes from. And there's so much information out there these days, and if we can help to educate, then that's what we'd love to do.
Well, you've done a good job of it today, Jason Diesel. I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
All right, Roger. Thank you very much.
Farm to Table Talk is supported by Larda Institute's Ag Innovation Showcase. With the pandemic upending supply chains, the economic health and well-being of farms and farmers, and the continued assault on food and agriculture, we need to move rapidly towards regenerative agriculture. Solutions are within our grasp when all stakeholders are unbridled by notions of what is possible and committed to what is necessary. To find energized ideas for the future of food and farming, go to agshowcase.com. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk.